Today's date is Wednesday, August the 10th, 2011. My name is Jonathan Gerland. We're in the History Center today, and I'm with Barley Linderman, and we're going to do an oral history interview. And Barley, if you would, maybe just begin by telling us when and how you came to work at the Angelina County Airport.
Okay, it's kind of a interesting story how I got started. The first thing I remember about the airport, I was raised, my formative years when I was young was in Burke. And I can remember when I was 4 or 5 years old riding over to the airport with my grandfather, and we'd watch the Trans-Texas DC-3s come in, and they'd turn and blow the wind, you know, the wind would blow us, and that just kind of fascinated me. And which, like I said, I was 4 or 5 years old, something like that, and which never give it a thought to the day that I'd spent a career out there before it was over with.
When were you born? What year?
1955.
Okay,
so, and so this was 60. Like 59 or so. I'd 60. Go out there with my grandfather. We'd go out there and we'd stand and watch the old DC-3s, Trans-Texas Airlines. But anyway, to get back a long story short, I was attending the Dieball school system. I went through Dieball High School, and when I was a junior in high school, the summer of my going into senior year, I went down to the personnel office at Temple looking for a summertime job, and they sent me over to Temple Industries Hangar to work on Saturdays for Mr. Bill Lindsay. He was chief pilot of Temple at the time. And I started out during the summer working over there, mowing the yard and cleaning all the airplanes. And at that time, Temple had one of the first Learjets, first business jets that actually come out. They had a Learjet and a Cessna 207 single-engine airplane and an old Aero Commander twin-engine airplane. And I cleaned the outside of these airplanes, swept the floor, and mowed the yard around the hangar and so forth. And in the meantime, my younger brother Dennis, which is 3 years younger than me, he got a job over at the airport for the county at the terminal, mowing and taking care of them, fueling airplanes and so forth. And it rocked on long before the end of the summer or so. The job was going to wind up being just a Saturday job, of course, after school started my senior year. And my brother told me, he said, they're looking for somebody else to hire over there to help fuel airplane stuff. And at that time, the fuel section of the county airport over there was running 13 hours a day fueling airplanes. So I went over and talked to the manager of the airport over at the time, which his name was Harold Ray Modisette, was the airport manager. And, of course, he knew me because I was working across the ramp over there at Temple Hangar. And he hired me. It was kind of an odd thing. He hired me for 5 cents more hour than what my brother was making. I believe it was $1.55 an hour at the time. So I went to work for the county over there, fueling airplanes and mowing, bush hogging, and working on runway lights, first one thing and another. And I went ahead and I worked over there in the afternoons and on Saturdays, and I graduated from high school in 1973, and I signed up, I accepted, and I went to SFA. Went up to orientation and got on my schedule and enrolled in the SFA. And all this same time, I was still working at the airport. Back then, the county did not pay overtime, and there was no limit on how many hours a person could work. And at the time, there was about 4 or 5 of us guys that was working just fueling airplane, doing maintenance, and we was working. We was getting paid on the 2 week schedule, and we'd have 104, 115 hours for 2 weeks work over there at the time. Of course, it was just straight time, no overtime or nothing. So it was quite flexible on when you worked. And so that made it real easy for me to go to SFA in the mornings, come back in down to Burke at the airport there and work at 12 or 1 o'clock. And then we closed at 8 o'clock at night. And so I worked my way. All the years I went to SFA, I went to SFA for a little over 4 years, 4 years a semester, I guess. But all this time, I was working 40 to 50 hours a week at the airport, too, because, you know, you could build up the hours like that. And I went to 4.5 years, you might say, of college at SFA and never missed a paycheck from the airport either. And in the meantime, the manager at that time, Mr. Monson, he had a lot of back trouble. And he had 2 or 3 surgeries, and he was off a whole lot. And so he got me to start doing the bookkeeping and accounting work for all the fuel cell stuff at the airport. And so more or less, I took this load on, plus he was just showing up maybe once every week or two, you know, when he wasn't having some of his troubles with his back and stuff. And so, make a long story short, I wound up doing accounting for the airport, plus kind of making sure that the guys kept all the airplanes fueled and we kept retail business going over there, plus keeping the maintenance of the airport up too. And so that started me out on the accounting and bookkeeping end of the business over there. And we was, at the time, we was probably selling 300,000 gallons of fuel a year or something like that. And we had, this was, we're talking mid-70s or so. We had, I think there was 30 or 35, maybe up 30 and 35 airplanes based at the airport at that time. There was the Temple Inland Hangar, and the county had three of the old Quonset-type hangars. And, of course, we had a terminal building, and that was the only thing at the airport. All we had was a rudimentary landing system, which was operated by, you know, they call it a VORTAC, V-O-R, out near Prairie Grove. And what this done, it's more or less just oriented airplanes on the compass degree heading to put them on the center line of the runway to land if it's bad weather. And the minimums back then was like, I believe it was 350 feet in a mile. And what this is saying, that airplane not supposed to descend any lower than that and have forward visibility of a mile, or it wasn't legal to land. But, of course, pilots being pilots, they would stretch this fact every chance they got. And that was one of the most intriguing parts of the job. When we had bad weather like January, February, you know, the flight service station, the guys over there, they was one to handle all the business end of the flight plans and the weather and stuff. We'd all go out and watch when somebody called in on the radio if they was going to try out approach. We'd all go outside the building and look through the fog and see if we could see the airplane coming in and all. They might miss it. We might see the airplane coming right over the hangar or so forth. It was kind of funny. But anyway, get back on my original story there. Like I said, the airport, we had about 35 airplanes or so based there at that time, and there was just a very few hangars. But we had a commuter airline in there coming in at that time. And the time I went to work there, TransTexas had already evolved into, they call themselves Texas International.
Now this is about, you started in 73, so this
73.
Would be
this would be 74, 75. Okay. They changed their name. It was Texas International Airlines. And they were flying the Convair 600, which was a 40-passenger turboprop. But they were running, I believe it was two flights a day to Dallas-Fort Worth area and then one to Houston. And they'd come back in at like 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and they'd pick up the passengers that were trying to go to Houston, and they'd carry them to Houston. And the morning flights at that time was all going to Dallas. Love Field started out, and then DFW opened at about 76, 77, I believe, when DFW Airport opened.
So these planes that took people from Lufkin to Houston, where were they based? At Lufkin, or did they just stop off at Lufkin between Dallas and Houston?
Right. The headquarters of Texas International at that time was in Longview. That was the original, and I think it was part of the old Longview. Gregg County used to have an Air Force base, kind of one of the reliever bases, and I think that they was using the building of the old reliever base, but that was where Texas International headquarters was at that time. But, of course, it was one of what was there, it was, they had the Essential Air Service deal through Congress at that time where they were subsidizing smaller communities, subsidizing them to get airline service into these places because they wouldn't pay it balance even as a whole. But that's a little bit further on in the story. But that's kind of what was the demise of the commuter service in the end at Lufkin, you know, because they cut the subsidy out, and so the later on commuter airlines, you know, it wasn't paying them to come in, so that's actually why we ain't got one right now. But anyway, but we had the flight service station out there, which was the opportunity for pilots to come in, file flight plans, and check the weather at Lufkin, or check the weather where they were going. And the flight service technicians in, I believe there was about 14 on the payroll out there then. It was 24 hours a day. There was a man sitting at the radio 24 hours a day there.
And whose payroll were they on?
Federal Aviation Administration. But they would take the flight plans and put them in the teletypes and in the computer, and that would be in the Federal Aviation System then, you know, and they'd know where this pilot, if it failed to show up, they'd know where to start looking for.
So they were FAA employees. It wasn't like reimbursed to the
FAA
county or anything.
Yeah, it was FAA
employees. They were FAA
employees.
People. They just were stationed at the county airport. Okay.
But it was 24 hours a day, and so you had a good many people were actually working under that one roof at that time. There was like 13 of those guys, and during the daytime there'd be two on duty there with the FAA. And then you had one maintenance technician that worked for the FAA, and his sole job was to keep all this federal equipment operating, teletype, so forth. And the air operation on my end of the deal down there, we had an airport manager, and we had, at the time, there was about five or six employees that fueled the airplanes, mowed the grass, worked on runway lights, and done the rest of the maintenance around the airport. And then we had the airline folks down there, which was, like I said, it evolved into Texas International, and there were three to four of the airline employees. It varied different times, but there's three to four airline employees down there. They sold the tickets, weighed the baggage, loaded the airplanes, and so forth on that. And they also made reservations. They were always hooked into the teletype system where they could make reservations if you wanted to connect with, at the time, Braniff or Delta or United, anybody that they could go ahead and sell you a ticket in Lufkin to go to New York if you wanted to go there from Lufkin. But so you had those employees there, and then you had a rent car agency in the terminal there. At the time, it was Hertz. When I went to work, at Hertz rent a car. It had a person there 8 or 9 hours a day. And then we had a cafe, of course, that they still got in the airport where the person could come in. If they stopped in Lufkin en route somewhere, they could get a hamburger or something. And that kind of helped us out on fuel sales because we'd get a lot of traffic that would stop in Lufkin to buy fuel simply because they could grab a snack or grab something to eat on the way. And so that was kind of a benefit for fuel sales and what we'd made in the cafe.
So how many were county employees, just county?
The cafe folks were county employees, and there was usually two to three of those in the cafe, and there was about seven to eight in the fuel office, the FBO we call it, the fuel office and fixed base operators, what FBO stands for.
Fixed
but there's seven to eight in that, and you had about three in the airline, you had about 13 in the FAA, one down at the FAA maintenance. And you had the rent car folks, and then, like I said, two to three in a cafe. You probably averaged 20 to anywhere between 20 and 23 people worked there, you know, every day at the airport at that time. Which part of that you got less now, partly because of course the automation and stuff. You know, that cut down on all kind of manufacturing. I mean, that was a mass exodus of manufacturing job when you just got computers, for instance, you know, and the same thing happened with the FAA. They eventually went to this system with a superstation, as they call it, and so they done away with the little places like Lufkin or wherever it had a flight service station.
I don't want to jump too far ahead, but I know eventually you went into management.
Right.
I guess my question was, and you know, I know we'll certainly get there when you get into the management mm-hmm. side of it, but you know, we'll be funding.
Yeah.
But how was it funded? You may not have known much about it at the time,
yeah.
but in looking back on it, how was it funded? How was it funded? You mentioned the subsidies
yeah.
of some of these other.
Well, I'm not. I can't speak with certainty about right now the way the economic situation is. But all through the years I worked there, we operated simply off of the profit from fuel sales and hangar rentals, and we always made money. We were never into the taxpayer's pocket out there because you know we. When I first went to work out there, we was probably selling 300,000 gallons a year. Well, back then, of course, fuel was a whole lot cheaper than it is now. But our revenues always exceeded our expenditures by usually, I can remember, I can speak from certainty for the last 10 years I worked, which I retired in 2002, that we would exceed our expenditures anywhere from $100,000 to $180,000 a year. That's profit. But what we would use this profit for, we would apply for these government grants, FAA grants, which were 90-10 grants. That's where the government give you 90% of, a $3 million project, and you had to have the money to match the other 10%. And so that's what we used our profit for, to match these grants. Say if you get a $4 million runway up here, that would say, you know, that we need to come up with 10% of that to match it, you know, and that's what we used our profit for. See, it was just kind of like the engine pulling the train,
right,
on the thing. And of course, the cafe never really completely made money per se in the cafe all the years I worked there, but it generated all this side money coming in because, like I said, you'd have people that, I mean, we'd get a Learjet in out there and they'd buy 600-700 gallons of jet fuel from you. That, hey, if we didn't have that place for them to grab a hamburger on the way to Atlanta, Georgia or something, they would land in Tyler or Conroe somewhere. And so I'd justify the cafe by using what, you know, that justification.
You would have lost
the fuel. True. It's true.
You would have lost the fuel sale. Yeah.
And see, but anyway, we always turned a profit out there. And it worked up to, at the time I retired, I was selling 1 million gallons a year. And it, of course, the fuel had got to the point, I think when I retired, it was running close to 2.5 or 2.75 a gallon. But we was turning about $1 a gallon profit off that fuel. And of course, that paid our salaries, paid the utilities on the airport, and left us money to match these grants with too. Which, like I said, I don't know. I can't speak with certainty whether the economic climate lets them do that now. But that's the way it was when I was out there. But we made money for the community, and also we had a lot of businesses that would actually, you know, I got into Chamber of Commerce before it was over with, just for information purposes mainly, but we had a lot of businesses that came to Atlanta County simply because they could fly corporate people in and try to, you know, make sales to them and so forth. So it was an actual big, it was a really a big economic benefit for the airport there.
I know we're kind of jumping around. I did want to come back to the money a little bit and talk mm-hmm. about some of the capital improvements,
yeah,
and you talk
yeah.
about these grants and stuff,
yeah.
but since you mentioned about corporates and mm-hmm. Things like that, where was Temple and all that as the business? Temple East Tech, Temple Inland?
Temple played a big part in it, and I'm sure they still do, but Temple played a big part in it because at that time, you know, this was starting in 1972, 73, and this was a real growing period. Temple, of course, if you think back, this was a year that they incorporated in 1973, I believe was a year. I may be off a year or two, but they got on the stock market.
They went public, yeah, in
right.
69, and then Time bought it in 73.
And you had, I can remember all the East Techs, the deals with them merging with the East Techs paper down at Evendale. And, of course, that put more flying and more business into the airport up here, and eventually we wound up with the entire aviation division. The East Techs merged with them up here, and we had a Temple went from having one Learjet and two small piston airplanes up here at one time. We had four jets sitting in Temple's hangar over there and two helicopters based right here in Lufkin. And one of the jets was, if you put airline configuration in, it would carry 80 passengers. That's a big airplane. And I can remember many months that I billed them $150,000 for fuel.
A month.
And so, you know, that's big, which it's the economy downturn now, and all in Temple doing their business processes and stuff. It's not near that now, you know, as far out here. But I can remember they were a huge part of our budget out there.
Were they the biggest?
Yes, undoubtedly, they were the biggest. And probably the second biggest income we had was the military government. We had a lot of Huey helicopters and Apaches and Black Hawks. I mean, a lot of military stuff come in out there.
And why would they come in?
There was a lot of traffic between Fort Hood and Fort Polk. And if you look on a map, we're just about halfway. And those helicopters are notoriously short-ranged on fuel. And so we was halfway, and so, man, we'd just pick up that traffic going and coming. And we always liked to see that because they were easy to deal with. They had a government credit card. Man, you just swipe through the machine, and you're gone. But so they were about the second biggest revenue that we had out there.
You think that's continuing today or not?
To an extent. Now, I don't think Fort, it just don't seem like Fort Polk is playing as much part in the operations as military in Texas as what it used to. I mean, they're not taking Louisiana, of course, but most of their flying. So I'm not really sure, but I don't think they're quite as big as they were. But they're still over here, though.
What about, like, some of the other companies, the paper mill, the Lufkin Industries?
We had Lufkin Industries. When I went to work out there, Lufkin Industries had a, they had one of the old DC-3s, which I still love to hear those things run. They had one of the old DC-3s down at Lufkin Industries, and they had a Beechcraft Baron. And that was one of the last DC-3s I know of that was actually still flying business in East Texas. Temple had one at one time, but that was before I went to work there. But Lufkin Industries had
a DC. Now, this is the same plane or the same type of plane that you enjoyed.
The Trans Texas, right. C-47 was a military version of it.
Yeah, the C-47.
They had a DC-3 and a Beechcraft Baron, Lufkin Industries. I owned in Southland Paper Mill, which they were still Southland at the time when I went to work out there. They had a Beechcraft King Air, which was a turboprop, pretty modern airplane for the time. But I can remember the old DC-3. We'd go down and fill that thing up with 100-octane aviation fuel, and every time you filled it up with fuel, you poured 5 gallons of oil in each engine. I mean, we just carried the 5 gallon pails of oil with us when we fueled the airplane. That was going to take 5 gallons. We had to use a ladder to climb up on the wing and pour these 5 gallon pails of oil in each engine.
It just burned that much.
That old radial engines, and if you ever seen a radial engine start up, you see the big puff of smoke blow, man. That's oil blowing off cylinders.
Now, those were four cycle engines, weren't they?
Big radials, you know, they did a round circle around through here.
But they just used a lot of oil.
Yeah.
Burned it unintentionally.
Yeah. but it was amazing. I've touched that before. God's been good to me because I had an amazing, amazing thing. That's the only job I ever had.
Yeah.
Right out there.
Yeah, I was going to ask you too. Did you finish your degree at SFA?
Never did. I was kind of one of these kind of guys. Of course, I was working at time and all, and I still am. I'm still guilty of that fact. My interest just jumps all over the chart, and I never could declare a major.
That's what I was going to ask you. What were you shooting for?
I've done everything from political science, climatic geography, history. I've done it all, but I never declared a major.
They didn't have an airport manager.
No, they didn't have one of those. I guess the smartest thing would be done was, you know, get a major in business or something. But I jumped all over the map, and I went about, I think, I must have 100. At the time, you had to have 130 hours, semester hours, I think, for a bachelor's degree, and I think I probably got 140 or 50, but I never majored, never finished nothing. But also, I had another thing play into the situation. At about the time that I should have really been getting serious about getting a degree up there, the airport manager that was having the back trouble that I spoke of before, he had to retire. He got disability, but he hurt his back at the airport working on a bush hog, but he had to retire. Well, the
airport manager was working on a bush hog.
I was helping him. He hurt his back, and that was the beginning of that. But anyway, to make a long story short, here he had to retire. All of a sudden, disability. Well, here, you know, there's no assistant manager slot out there then. Well, you know, here that left me. I was already keeping the books. And so I just kept keeping the books and trying to run the airport too and stuff and all. And I'd done this for about 6-7 months, you know, and all. And that's when I think I skipped a semester of SFA and was working on that. And Commissioner's Court was overseeing, they was the umbrella over the airport. They had an airport board. It was an advisory board, advisory is what it is. You know, they give you advice. But anyway, they opened the job up. The Commissioner's Court opened the job up for resumes or whatever. And I put my resume in at that time, which I was, you know, what, that 20-21 years old, and one of the flight service guys that had retired from the Federal Aviation Administration put his resume in, and there's two or three more. And anyway, to make a long story short, I came out second in the deal, and so they appointed Chuck Moore, Walter L. Moore, airport manager. And of course, I was still keeping the books and all this. Well, Chuck, I knew him because I'd worked with him out there before he retired, and we got along real well.
He was the FAA guy.
He was the FAA guy, but right. He got the job at airport.
The flight service station person, okay.
Right. He was a friend of mine. We got along real well, but he had retired, and he was a lot older. We all kind of looked at him, you know, as a mentor. You know, he could give us advice. But anyway, he got the job, and so I was working for him, and I was still keeping the books and all, you know, and all. And he told me, he said, you know, just keep doing what you're doing, you know, and all this kind of stuff. We got along real well. And so I worked under him, and eventually after about a year, well, he convinced Commissioner's Court to, hey, name him assistant manager, give him a slot, you know, a position where, you know, I'd have some standing anyway, you know, which I was doing all the bookkeeping all this time anyway, so I knew everything going on at the airport. In fact, I knew more than what he did about the financial parts of it now. But I'd done this for about 5 years, I guess. And
who was the county judge then?
Dan Jones, county judge. when I first went to work out there, Claude Welch was still county judge. But anyway, Dan Jones was judge when they hired Chuck as the airport manager to take over. But I got named assistant manager, and I was doing all the bookkeeping and all. I'd done that several years. And then in 1990, Chuck retired. He said, I'm put in all these years with the federal government and done this, and I guess he vested with the county's retirement system also. He retired. Well, I sent my resume up there again, and they appointed me, which I'd done been there for years and years and years at that time, And I said, 1990, I believe, was the year that I became airport manager. And all during this period of time, we was, getting more and more airplanes basing at the airport and all.
Talk a little bit about some of the capital improvements. Improvements around the airport itself.
When I went to work out the airport, we had four runways, which is actually, when you look at it from there, it looks like two, but you got a runway number from each end. Had two runways there, and one of them was, I think it was 4,200 feet long, and the other one was 3,600 feet long, and they were gravel. Now, can you imagine this, which I don't know, you may not be familiar with, but I say gravel, they were chip seal runways, which you got the tar laid down like they lay on the highway out here, and then they come along and sprinkle rock on top of it.
I think they've been doing that here.
Yeah, that's the most dangerous thing you can do for a propeller airplane, because the propeller is going to get chipped when it sucks that rock up.
Yeah.
But that's the way the runway were then.
Now, that wasn't just here, that was fairly common.
Well, it was probably pretty common there because, I don't know. But, that's one of the biggest dangers you have. Is gravel hitting a propeller doing 900 miles. The RPMs of a propeller, 9,000 RPM. But anyway, not long after I came to work, it must have been about 74 or so, we started to really beginning to get lucky on getting these government grants to extend these runways. And the first time, I think we extended the 3,800 foot runway out to 4,000 feet. And that would be the north-south runway. Went to 4,000 feet. And then we got another grant to extend the east-west runway, and we went to 4,600 feet.
Now, what types of plane? Did that enable you to handle bigger planes?
Yeah, when we went to 4,000 foot was at that time anyway, it was kind of the magic number whether you could safely handle the average business jet. Anything less than that, now they land them there a lot of places, but you lose that margin of safety. But we went to that 4,000, which Temple, at that time, Temple had their Learjet, and they were flying in and out on 4,000 foot. But we went to 4,400 feet, and then when I was manager in 1992, we extended the east-west runway to 5,200 feet, which is right at a mile. And we got another grant for $3 million when we put the instrument landing system in. And that was the biggest boon that we ever had, was that instrument landing system, because that took all this worrying about whether they're going to make it in a fog or not out. That instrument landing system would put them on the center line of the runway if they followed that right down. And so that lowered the minimums of landing, and so we could handle stuff that other airports couldn't handle in here when we got that ILS. They call it ILS, but it's the instrument landing system. We got that in 92. along with that 5,200 foot runway, so we could almost handle anything.
And that was mostly with federal
grants.
Was that like a 9010 also?
9010. Everything we've got was 9010 out here.
How much work was it to get that grant?
It was a lot of work, because the main part of the work was you had to acquire the land. We didn't have the land, so we'd have to start negotiating with the land.
And where did that come from? Who owned the land?
Well, the land that we put the landing system out on belonged to the Treadwell and Connor family up here at Burt. Old line family's been there since there was a Burt existed. And the south end of the airport, you always dealt with the Fairchild family on the south end of the airport. And then the east end, you always dealt with the Burruses. And so through the years, I think I looked the other day, I've still got at home a list of all the people that we'd bought land from ever since the airport was built in 1947, I think. And there is something like, I don't know, 44 different landowners that had been dealt with through there, through the years acquiring property. But if you run into somebody, you know, that we, one time we run into a person that just wouldn't sell, and we had to have the property. The government told us we had to have it. And we went to file for eminent domain, which everybody hates that and all, and I do as much as anybody else, but I mean, but we filed for eminent domain, and in eminent domain, a person that's trying to acquire the property puts up in escrow account the value of the property, which has been established, and it sets up in court, whether it goes to court. But anyway, it was settled before it ever went to court, and we bought the property. But that's how we always, but the property acquisition, you know, and then you had to pick engineering firms, and it was just mostly a lot of meetings and discussing the pros and cons of this company versus that company and this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And of course, you had an FAA guy sitting in on everything that happened, you know, to make sure that we was crossing all the T's and dotting
the I's. How competitive was it? Was the Angelina County Airport competing against some regional ones for the same thing?
It was pretty competitive. In fact, you know, right down to the Oldville and Lufkin and Nacogdoches. Now, we had some a lot of competition with Nacogdoches. We usually came out on the top end of the deal.
Why do you think that was?
Well, I don't know. I like to think that we just put on a good proposal. But Nacogdoches did pull, the Nacogdoches actually scored some runs too on the deal there, but it was kind of political over there. They had a congressman one time that was kind of intervening a little bit on them getting a landing system before there's some more. We got a landing system for anybody else up here. But Nacogdoches kind of slipped in and got one through the back door, which was real smart in the way they done it.
This is all with the feds, right?
Right. I mean, they convinced a commuter airline to come into Nacogdoches under the condition that they'd get an instrument landing system over there. Well, they carried this proposal to the congressman that was serving at the time and said, hey, we can get an airline in here, but we got to have an instrument landing system. Well, the congressman here, we earmarked money for them an instrument landing system just due to the fact that they had more or less put out some monetary incentives to get this airline to come in, so they kind of backdoored beating us out on that deal. Well, they'd actually beat us out, but all this money is in competition through block grant program. The Federal Aviation Administration gives TxDOT Aviation Division X millions of dollars a year, and this to be distributed out to deserving airports and projects. And so everybody in the state is competing for this block grant of money and to get their part of it, you know. And so TxDOT Aviation Division over in Austin, you know, for it all starts out, I'll write them a letter requesting, hey, we need this and all, and then they'll send me back, well, give me some background on why you need this and all. And it was kind of one of these kind of deals of how you get the grants, so whether you can justify, hey, we really need this.
Who would you say has been some of the good friends of the airport in government, politics, whatever you want to say, but...
Say what you want to, but Phil Grimm helped us out, you know, which Phil had his detractors and advantage in this, but Phil Grimm really helped us a whole lot when he was in Congress. But we had some good folks that would go to bat for us over in Austin, too. In fact, I wound up being good friends with one of the Division of Aviation, the administrator, and I think he's still in office over there.
Who's that?
His name is Dave... If you hadn't asked me, I could tell you.
I'm sorry.
He's on the website anyway. Okay. David Fulton. He's the minister. I think he's still working over there too. But
okay.
He helped us out a whole lot because I'd get on the phone and I'd talk to those people and I'd finally get him on the phone and he'd sometimes fly over and have lunch with me, you know, whatever. And I'd say, Dave, we sure need this or whatever, you know, and all. And which it's just like anything else. It's justification and selling your idea to them.
Talk a little bit about some local politics, and maybe that's not a good way to ask it, but just the working relationship with the county government. I know, and what I'm mm-hmm. kind of what I know of is recently, you know, some of the mm-hmm. stuff that's been in the newspapers in the past year about the you were talking about the cafeteria. And,
you know,
is it making money? Is it not making money?
Well, I always made sure that when we had a new commissioner or a new commissioner's court elected, I wanted those people to see what we were doing out there. And I would get them out there and feed them a hamburger, and we'd either walk or get in a truck or something, and I'd show them what we were doing and what we were expected to do out there and what we hoped to do. But I mean, I educated them, and I thought, you know, you had to do that. Everybody got to do that. And I could show, I could carry them in there to my desk, and I'd pull out the figures and show them, say, here, well, we're paying our way. Show me where some of these other folks are paying their way, you know. But they all understood. I worked with some real good people, and the commissioners all really backed me. I can think of very few occasions where I didn't get what I needed. And I think it, in Austin, too, I had some real good people. I had real good work in Austin. In fact, we'd done so good over there that one of the high points of my career out there was in 1997. We were named Texas Airport of the Year. Out of 310 airports in Texas, we were on the cover of their airport directory, the picture of the Angelina County Airport. I went over, me and the county judge, Barry, at the time, and we had a big banquet, and we had, you know, 1,000 people in the room there, you know, and called me up, and they gave, you know, and that was a big high point, because there's very few airports that gets that.
I think it may still be there, but I know there used to be that little sign underneath it. Is it still there?
I think it is.
Airport of the Year or something.
There was
like
a plaque hanging somewhere in the building there, but that was kind of the high point of the deal, because I figured, you know, they recognized us. We made it.
And who gives that? Who gave
Texas,
that?
Texas Department of Transportation, Aviation Division.
Department of Transportation.
But we were named Airport of the Year. Went to Austin and got it at a banquet.
You mentioned a little bit, you know, the FAA being there, the Flight Service Station, and included with that, is that the National Weather Service Station, or is that different?
Excuse me. The Federal Aviation folks out there, the Flight Service Station, we call them, they were certified for, they were weather certified, and they did the observations every hour on the hour. And this was in addition to their duties of talking to the airplanes on the radio, fighting flight plan stuff. But each one of those were weather certified, where they were certified. And they did this weather observation for them. You know, of course, like I said, they were 24 hours a day. Every hour on the hour, they might miss it by a minute, but they were out swinging their thermometer doing the weather observation. They come back in and set it down on the teletype, tapped it in there, and it went all over the world, you know, what the weather was.
Part of that NOAA, like the NOAA
National
Network.
Oceanic Atmosphere, but they handle that, too.
And so those are actually people on the spot. Mm-hmm. And, of course, nowadays...
Yep. Nowadays, they got an automated system out near Farm Road 2108 there that does it all automatically.
And that happened during your time.
Mm-hmm. Right. This was in a...
Can you talk a little bit about that?
must have been about 96, 95 or 96. The flight service stations, as we knew them, ended. They went to the super stations. And
how did that affect what you were doing? I mean, I know they were there, you know, but
It affected the economy, because you lost that many people up here that all of a sudden wasn't living in Angelina County then. And they had a problem at the time because, hey, we've shut the flight service station down. It's all been handled out of Conroe. What one computerized? You got 110 people working down here, I believe, doing this. But we still got to have a weather observation to made in Lufkin every hour. What do we do? Well, to settle that problem, they contracted for about a year while they was trying to get this automated weather station assembled and in Lufkin. They contracted it out with a company that put a man sitting in a desk there, and all his job was once an hour to do this for about a year and a half before they got the automated system in. But they kind of put the cart before the horse down here and moved all of them off, and then decided, hey, we got to have weather in Lufkin, you know.
Of course, I know it's still... They still have reports today, and I guess it's some of that same automation that they set up back then.
Yeah.
But you've already talked a little bit about it, but, you know, that was one of the questions was technology, just how technology changed during your time, and anything else?
It was greatly. I can remember the flight service station, like I said, dinner. They had the weather station, and they had a fax machine, a huge fax machine, probably 4 foot wide, that printed out the paper with a weather satellite map on it. And for some reason, the paper was always wet. I guess it was some kind of electrical charge went through it and made the actual lines and so forth for isobars and millibars on the paper. And then, of course, you didn't have the computers then, they had the teletypes where they'd sit on the console and type on a teletype, and at the same time it run out of ticker tape, you know, the little holes in the paper, and they'd poke this in there, and they'd in the teletype machine, if they wanted to send one, they'd thread it in there, and it would zip through here, you know, and it was just holes in the paper at reading. Wasn't any such thing as a portable computer back then. And like I said, the weather observation people, they would walk out and swing one of the old thermometers. They'd leave it sitting in a cup of water for some reason to get the ambient temperature the same or something. But they'd pick their thermometer up, walk out the door, and swing the thermometer, you know, and in the air, and then look at it, and then they'd come in and write all this down. And here they'd be on the teletypes. Again, teletypes were a big thing back then because that's the only way they had to communicate what was going on. Airline down there was the same way. They had, if you bought a ticket there, they didn't type it in on a computer or something and your name was in Dallas or wherever. It was done with a teletype also. So they had teletypes down there at the airline too. Through the years, I hadn't really touched on it much, but through the years, after Texas International Airline, they'd done some mergers. They merged with Continental Airlines down in Houston. And, of course, you know, you done got a big player in the game then, and Lufkin was a small fish, and so they pulled out of Lufkin. That left us without an airline at the time. So some of the powers that be in the county, and also I think the state folks helped us too. We started looking for another commuter airline to come in and fill that gap. And at the same time, the federal government cut back on a little bit of this subsidy that they were paying Texas International to come into Lufkin. They cut it back from like $110,000 a year like to $80,000, which was just a check to them to come into Lufkin and plus whatever they made off of Lufkin. And we got there was an upstart little airline down near Clear Lake that was ferrying NASA people around called Metro Airlines. And they got started simply to fly NASA employees from the airports in Houston over to the facility at Clear Lake, NASA. And so they branched off from there and bought three or four more airplanes. They were flying the de Havilland Twin Otters, which was a high-wing, twin-engine turboprop airplane. And they expressed interest in flying into Lufkin, and they set up the same thing with Tyler and Longview. And so they set up office in Lufkin, and they were flying from Houston to Lufkin, leaving Lufkin, and flying to Tyler, Longview, and then to DFW. And then they'd do the whole thing backwards again each day. And they flew in and out of Lufkin for about 3 to 4 years, I guess. And they were the last one airline that I knew of that actually made a profit out of Lufkin. I think they made a profit.
What about Chaparral? I remember seeing something.
Chaparral like Airlines, they came in as when Metro Airlines sold, they sold. At the time, a lot of these larger airlines
buying out these little ones. What year would this be?
This would be in the early 80s, 81, okay. 82, something like that. And then when Metro pulled out, you had a Chaparral Airlines moved in. And I think their headquarters was in Abilene, I believe. They started flying in, and they operated in and out of here for a year and a half or 2 years. Maybe.
But they still got subsidies.
Right, they got some subsidies. And then Chaparral folded their doors. I don't remember exactly what the consequences, what were the reasons they went out of business, but we had one other one try it called Syntex Airlines. And they were flying their headquarters in Brownwood, and they had twin-engine Piper Navajo airplanes. And they were running a couple of flights, two or three flights a day out of Lufkin. And they didn't last but probably a year and a half, something like that. And, in fact, Ben Barnes, the ex-lieutenant governor, owned part of Syntex Airlines. And that was after the Sharpstown deal was all over with and so forth.
So what we're talking about is passenger service planes.
Right.
And so when did all that end for the
commuter airlines? The last one we had, it was probably in 85 or 86.
Okay. What about mail? Was any mail being carried while you were there?
Yeah, when I went to work over there in the early 70s and up to the 80s, I guess Texas International, that was one of their big things. They hauled a lot of mail in Texas International. Those old Convair 600s, they had a cargo door. They'd open up and they'd have four or five of the orange bags of mail in there, you know, and they hauled a lot of freight, too. And then after they left, I think Metro Airlines was still flying a little bit of mail. And during the time Metro was flying in out of here, for some reason the Postal Service discontinued flying it. And they was, I guess, trucking it to Houston or somewhere then, but the mail ended.
What about like United Parcel Service? Were they flying in when, during your time?
Yeah, they got started. I don't remember the year, but before then we even had one. It was flying freight out there called SMB Stage Lines, and they'd leave an airplane there all night, and it would fly out every morning, come back at night. SMB Stage Line. They flew air freight, and they flew a little bit of mail too. And they had the old Beach 18, Twin Beaches. And they flew to Dallas, flew the mail and freight to Dallas. And then from Dallas, I found out later, they had hubs all over Missouri and all. That was the name of it, Sedalia Marshall Boonville, where the SMB name came from. But they flew freight out of there.
Now, UPS, what did they fly?
UPS started out, they always contracted with a charter service or something. And they, most of the time, for about 5 or 6 years, up until about 2 years before I retired, they had an outfit called Martin Air. Martin Air had about 20 airplanes, I guess, and they kind of specialized in contracted with FedEx or UPS. And they flew all the UPS in and out of Lufkin. The airplane would sit at the airport over here all day, and then they'd fly out late in the afternoon. We'd fuel them up. They'd fly out, and then 7:30 in the morning after we opened the airport, we'd look up and there they'd come in landing with a UPS truck be out to meet them. And they'd done this for, I guess, 4, 5, 6 years. The Martin Air was flying the United Parcel Service.
Do you know where their planes went? Did they all go to Houston? Or
they were going to Dallas.
Muskegee?
Dallas.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I worked there in the late 80s at UPS. I remember our hub was Mesquite.
Well, that may have been where they went somewhere, but... The Martin Air, almost, I guess they had a kind of a lock on that contract because they've done that for years.
I guess it might be a little different before you became manager and then when you did become manager, but if there is such a thing, describe a typical day, and if not a typical day, maybe a day that, you know, within a couple week period, you know, and especially as airport manager, mm-hmm. you know, just tell us
at the time we were open from 7 o'clock in the morning and we wouldn't close until dark or even after dark, you know, before the time change deal, but we was open from around 12 to 13 hours a day. But I would come to work at 7 o'clock.
Was this before you were manager or after?
This was after all the time, actually. Okay. But when I was manager, I'd get there at 7 when my first guy got there, where I was there to oversee whatever went on. I would get there, and my fuel guy would get there or whatever, and I'd go in there and gather up all the invoices from the day before and the credit card slips and the cash and stuff, and I'd go in, and before I got computers, I would do this on ledger forms and stuff. I'd do each day as a page, you know, all the cash sales, the credit card sales, and the charge sales. We'd run a lot of charge accounts with local people. But I'd done all that, and then I'd make the bank deposits up, and I'd make bank deposits a couple times a week. And at the same time, my fuel guy, he was fueling all the people that would be leaving early in the morning, you know, like Temple or anybody else that had a business trip that day. He'd be out, we'd be getting calls, hey, come down, fuel Temple's Learjet or fuel this. He'd be fueling the planes and stuff, and then the cafe ladies would get there, and I'd give them their cash, petty cash, to operate out of for the day. They would open up the cafe, you know, and get ready to serve a hamburger or breakfast, whatever the folks in there. And usually it took me about an hour, hour and a half to do all the bookkeeping and so forth, unless it was the end of the month. The end of the month, that was an all-day deal, because back then, in fact, I even used to have an old Underwood typewriter. I'd type out each invoice and stuff, you know, and all. It was all by hand. And we'd get fuel deliveries, and, of course, we had inventory to keep up with on the fuel, and you would have to check quality control every morning, because this aviation gas has got a tendency to, these tanks to condensate, and you get condensation in them. And the first thing, with the guy that would get there to fuel the airplane, I mean, to work the line every morning, it was part of his job. He'd go out with his pad and he'd get the meter readings, you know, for the fuel that was sold that the day before, you know, the meter readings started that day. That's how we kept up with how much fuel was sold. And this meter readings had to match the number of tickets to the fuel that was sold by gallons. But he had to drain the sumps in the trucks and on the tanks, because we had 10 or 12,000 gallon tanks. You might get a quart or two of water out of each one of them every day. And, you know, water in airplanes, you don't put water in an airplane. So we'd drain the sumps, you know, and he'd drain the sump, you know, which was at the bottom of the big fuel tank. he'd open this valve up and hold a bucket under it, and then this fuel and water would run out until you got just clear fuel, and then he'd shut it off, you know, and then he poured it in a barrel, would keep the fuel and water mixture, which nowadays I guess that would be completely illegal. You'd have to do something else with it. But and at that same time, when I first went to work there, of course, you know, the FAA people, they were there, like I said, 24 hours a day, so the airport, the doors, they never actually closed on the airport. But then we'd fuel airplanes all day, and then my other, I would always have one or two guys that would just come on, and usually they would concentrate on keeping all the grass mowed or the lights fixed or some of this stuff, you know. In other words, somebody always kept an eye on the money was the fuel going into airplanes. Somebody always concentrated on that first, and then number two was the maintenance and stuff. But we'd kind of handle everything.
What might be some issues that might come up during the day, or
well, that's one thing about
problems
that,
or anything. But
that was one part of it being such an interesting job, is because you never know what's going to break down next. You know, it's just like any other business.
What if
I have been out when it was 20
down.
Degrees working on runway lights, trying to dig in the mud and stuff to fix this electrical cable it broke into. I've been up on a beacon tire when it was 25 degrees trying to fix that big circling rotating light that everybody's seen. It's been some, I mean,
your predecessor ruined his career working on a bush hog.
I mean, it was something every day. It was not a boring job by any extent. Yeah. You never knew who, we touched on this a little bit before, but you never knew who's allowed to land, step out of an airplane next. I've met two presidents out there, met every governor of Texas. I met most of nearly every officer in the state of Texas. I've met all sorts of the movie stars, singing stars. And I remember back when I mentioned earlier to you the other day, back SFA used to sponsor a whole lot of the rock acts would come play at the Coliseum or somewhere. And I've met, especially back in the golden days, I call it of the aviation that rock and roll had. You know, every big band had an old airplane, which it killed a lot of them. Leonard Skinner got wiped out in an airplane. Ricky Nelson. But all of them had to get them a big old airplane. Usually they bought an old airplane. It had been flown by an airline until they had so many hours on it. The airline had to park it. But all these rock bands, they'd come in all kind of airplanes and stuff, you know. We had the band Chicago and the Eagles and Boston. I remember Boston came in an old Lockheed Electra one time. Gosh, those things have been falling out of the air for 20 years when they come in with that thing. They lost one up near Buffalo, Texas.
Did you get any of their autographs? I mean,
yeah, I've got several of them. I was digging around the other day and I come across in my drawer, I found a picture of Merle Haggard where he wrote to Barley, one of the good old boys, on it. And I've got one of Linda Ronstadt when she played over at SFA. And I've met, you know, movie stars, television stars. But
so what, when they landed, did they pretty much have like limos waiting for them?
Some of them did and some of them didn't. Not only it's kind of weird that you meet some of them that you can just tell right off the hand, say, hey, this guy's just like I thought of. And then you get one that you think is a nice guy, and all, and he gets out and turns to, you can kind of get a little bit of a darker picture of the guy.
Hmm.
One of them, I think, right off hand, which I guess we could be slandering people here, but I better not get into that on this tape anyway. But there's some of them that you think was not real nice guys, and you need to start talking to them and all. And, hell, they just piss you off right quick.
Really? Now, how were the Eagles, the members?
They were nice people. Nice people.
Joe Walsh.
I remember Henley telling me that he was from East Texas.
Yeah, he's up around Caddo Lake area. Did you talk any with people like Joe Walsh? Or, you know, he was.
I don't remember him. I can remember Henley sticks out in my mind for some reason. Henley. But I met a lot of the old television stars that I grew up with. Fess Parker, now that was the nicest guy you ever met. Which he just recently did. Fess Parker, James Drury, the little guy played Virginian. I met him.
Fess Parker, yeah, he was.
He played Daniel Boone, David Crockett, and all that. He was
Walt Disney. Now, why did they come in for just shows in Lufkin and Nacogdoches, or?
The Fess Parker came in. He was buying cattle here. From Harry English had a Red Brummer ranch up here between Lufkin and Burke there. And he would have these sales, big shows, you know, with selling the Brummer cattle. Fess Parker was in the cattle business. And he came in to see or buy some of those cattle. And then, like most of the musical groups were going to play a concert or something somewhere. I can remember back in the late 70s when the first few stars I ever met, which, you know, was kind of real exciting at the time, There was a big place opened up in Lufkin on the loop over there. It wound up being a skating rink, but it was called the Showboat at that time, and they were going to have musical acts and stuff and kind of have a BYOB deal. Hmm. And it run for about a year, but they booked some pretty big people in there, because I never will forget walking into the airport there. I went to work at 11 o'clock that day. I was going to SFA. Walked in the lobby, and there was Texas International Airlines had a flight scheduled to come in like 12 or 12:15. Walked in alone, looked over, and this fellow sitting in the lobby there had a cowboy hat on and a pair of faded out blue jeans. I looked, and Marty Robbins sitting in there. And he had played this Showboat Club up there the night before or something.
Hmm.
And then when George Jones had his musical park down here in McColesman's, Neil, they were a lot of them flying in for that down there. I met, you know, the Conway Twitties and the Tanya Tuckers and all those. They used, because this was the closest airport of any site they could get a small business jet or whatever a star would be flying in, you know, to drive to Coleman Neil. Of course, George Jones flew out of here a lot. Because, I mean, George Jones was in and out of here near every weekend because he'd go down there and been doing it, run his thing, and go back to Nashville during the week. Mm. But I remember Walter Mundell, very plain. I never will forget Walter Mundell came up here. He spoke at a chamber banquet. Him and Ed Koch, the mayor of New York, came in. And we spent 2 weeks with some Secret Service guys. You know, I mean, this is, we're talking vice president here. I mean, it's not, we spent 2 weeks with Secret Service guys. They'd show in up every other day.
But it was a sitting vice president.
Yeah, he was sitting vice president. But that the Secret Service show up, and they wanted personnel record on this guy, worked with me, worked for me, this guy and all, you know, and they run all kind of backgrounds, and they had all kind of, every other day they'd having a planning meeting, you know, the highway patrol folks there, and had the DPS helicopter crew from Beaumont was up here, you know, to provide security, and they want to know, is this door usually shut, is this door, is this gate usually shut on this yard, this hurricane fence over here, what's going on here, and I mean, it was never ending deal there, and it was kind of ironic to me, because they flew in two C-130s, one of the C-130s had a limo in it. They backed the limo out, but they come to find out they always carried a spare airplane anyway. But the C-130 landed and taxied down. And he it was so big we couldn't turn it around. And he parked on the end of the runway. And then here come the C-130 in with Mundell on it. Well, I had my parking chops out, and, you know, I was going to park him, you know, which that was kind of exciting at the time, you know. I mean, hell, you know, I had one of the 20s in it. Things were still a lot more interesting then than what they are now. But I get out here and park Mundell. And had a bunch of people lined up all up down the fence there, and Ed Koch got out first, and then Mundell. Well, Mundell come around, I shook his hand and all, you know, and all. And my guys, I had three fuel guys working at the time, and, you know, we had to keep traffic going in now there at the same time. We had, you know, the business still went on, even though you had vice president there. And my guys, which two of them were local kids, you know, and all lived around Fairview over there. Anyway, and one of them is a pilot. One of them wound up being a corporate pilot, and he's a pilot now that worked for me. But anyway, I shook Mondale's hand. He come on in, and I don't think I ever actually met Koch. But they came on into the hurricane fence there in the yard of the airport, and I looked over, and there were two of my guys. It was a Beechcraft King Air came in, taxied up, and my guys were always trained to park the airplane and ask them if they need fuel. I mean, that's the way you meet and greet and sell fuel. Well, I hadn't told him any different, and the entrance to the tarmac out there was kind of crowded with people to see Mundell. So they got the bright idea. They just run over to the hurricane fence, and here they just grab a hold of it and jump over the fence to the fuel trucks. Well, their feet had them on hit the ground. Secret Service had them by the elbow here. And all the time, they gave us a little pen that said A on them. I guess it's for airport or authorized or something. But I was pulling, I said, hey, they all right, you know, and all. But I mean, but that's how meticulous they was about this. They had my guys by the shirt collar by the time their feet hit the ground when they jumped that fence, and they were just jumping the fence to go park the airplane to the fuel truck.
Well, it made you feel like they were doing their jobs anyway.
Yeah.
On both camps.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. Talk about some of the more memorable people that you worked with. You mentioned celebrities and things, but I mean like pilots that might have been regulars out there, like Horace McQueen, you know, some of those kind of people. Anything you want to share about that? Or?
Well, they were 99% of those people were real good people, I thought, and all that I hadn't really thought a lot of. Two of them, of course, were killed in there at the Luffin Industries plane crash back in 81 or 82. One of those guys that was killed in that plane crash gave me my first airplane ride. Ray Fisher was his name. But I'll never forget, I fueled that airplane that morning that it crashed up in Denver there, right out of Denver, and killed those 10 folks. And that was a blow. But through the years, I've had some scary times out there, but there's never anybody. My 29 and a half years I was there with the county, which is a total of 30 if you wanted to count the summer I worked for Temple. Nobody ever killed on my watch out there. But I was always very scared of something was going to happen. You know, I had some close calls. We had one airplane that was completely loose control and went through a hangar and burned a hangar and the airplane, both of them. But the two guys got out of it. Okay, one of them was a doctor. But I was happy to stand in the door of the terminal, was looking out at the runway when I seen the airplane hit the runway and bounce into the air and came down. One wing was on the ground. It come spiraling across the tarmac right into one of our old hangars there. All I could think of was, oh my God, and I ran out the doors there and grabbed up a 75-pound fire extinguisher that I couldn't do it right now at all and ran down there with that fire extinguisher. Probably 200 yards to the hangars, and by the time I got down there, I could just see fire going everywhere, and I didn't know where those two guys on that airplane was. I thought they were in the airplane. It had one wing, and it just sawed through the hangar, and the airplane fuselage was right on the outside, and of course, you had 100 gallon, 100 octane fuel. It was one heck of a fire going there, and I couldn't see those two pilots, those two guys on the plane. Scared me to death, and I started spraying that fire extinguisher. Blew it out and didn't even make any effect on the fire. And we had one airplane that sitting in that hangar there, and the fire was burning all around it. And all I could think of, well, I've saved this airplane. So I started pulling this airplane out. And Bruce Owens, who was Temple's helicopter pilot at the time, came over and helped me. And we pulled the airplanes out of that hangar to save them from burning in there, too. And come to find out, the two guys had got out of the airplane and ran to the hurricane fence. They were standing behind the hangar. But I thought they were in the airplane originally. But that was scary. But about once a year, we'd have an airplane land with wheels up. That happened pretty regular, which usually that was no big. The airplane would skid on the belly, and that would be about it, you know. But we had one old boy out there that was. They got wound up arresting him for drugs. He folded. He crashed a 172 out there one time and just balled it up into a ball of scrap metal. Fuel drinking everywhere, and we got down there. It was right at dark one night. We got down to the crash site there, and all right off the side of the runway. They was fuel just leaking out of the old airplane wings, and they was all crumpled up. He was wanting out there wanting a light for his cigarette, sitting running up fuel going everywhere and all. And we called the highway patrol in the meantime. They got out there, and they went up. They carried the old boy in, done a drug test on him, and he had drugs in his system and stuff and all. And then we had two or three actual drug busts out at the airport. One of them, we had a twin-engine airplane, flew in a whole load of 700 pounds of marijuana from Belize, and they surrounded it and accosted it out there about 11 o'clock one night.
Now, were they already looking for it, or did y'all alert them or anything?
They were tracking it. Okay. Then we had one old boy was flying in some kind of synthetic drug in from Austin area over there, and he was bringing it in balloons. And they arrested him midday over one day.
Now, did law enforcement alert y'all that
we always knew what was happening.
Okay, so they alerted you, hey, a plane fixing to land.
I went out and met the old boy that had the balloons full of dope and asked if he needed fuel or whatever, and I knew that we had undercover Lufkin. They had a task force in the county. It was Lufkin Police, some sheriff's department guy, and DPS, all undercover. They were all over the airport when this old guy came in. I asked him if he needed fuel. He went in a new building, and I knew they was going to arrest him, but I didn't know when. And they went up, arrested him in the bathroom. And he had some of those balloons full of dope on him, but he was flying it in.
But you went ahead and went out and asked him if he needed fuel, huh?
Yeah. I fueled a whole plane load of dope out there one night at 2 o'clock in the morning. That was another thing.
You did it knowingly at the time?
Yeah. About 2 o'clock one morning, one of the flight service guys called me on the phone. You know, we had a call-out system where if somebody needed fuel, they paid extra, we'd come out and fuel them. About 2 or 2:30 in the morning, I got a call on that to come out, somebody needed fuel. And I get up going out there, and I I'm talking to the flight service guy. Flight service station still open. Then a fellow named Roger Parker was working that shift. He told me, he said, Barley, said, DEA called me and said, you're going to have a plane. You got a plane that was inbound that they're tracking. And he said, apparently they've done called you needing fuel. And I said, yeah, I got to call somebody that was fixing to be in out there needing fuel or whatever. I think they'd call me from on the ground down around Houston or somewhere. But anyway, I come out there and I get out there and Roger tells me, he said, they're going to land. Said, but the DEA is tracking them in another airplane, but they're running without lights. And so I get out there, you know, and sure enough, I see a landing light didn't come on until they was a mile or two off the runway, but this twin engine airplane landed, you know, and I went out there and the guys were just nice as all get out. We need some fuel, fill both main tanks and all, and I put like 50 gallons on each side of it. They pay with a credit card, and all the time I'm fueling them, I'm looking around there, and the door's open on the airplane. It was a big twin engine Piper Navajo, whatever it is. I fueled them up, and then when they paid for the fuel, and they left. Taxied out, took off, and lights went out. A few minutes later, here come Roger said, well, here comes the feds now. Well, we could hear the airplane. We're standing outside the building. I could hear it, but we couldn't see it. They didn't have any lights on. They were running without lights. They landed in one of their King Airs, and I poked 100 gallons of fuel and jet fuel in them right quick, and they gave me a credit card, and I run in a credit card, but I could see they had gun racks with M16 or something in their airplane. I run in, run their credit card through, you know, all right fashion. They took off without any lights chasing them. And I always wondered, the next day we finally found out, me and Roger, he came to work back at 2 that afternoon. We was trying to find out, and you know, we got involved in this. Where did they get them at? Did they get them? We finally found out they arrested them in Oklahoma. But that was one thing that always kind of bothered me. When you get called out at 2 o'clock in the morning, you never know who you're going to run into out there. And I'd always carried a gun with me.
Now, who's the DEA for the recording?
The Drug Enforcement Agency.
Okay.
But you never knew what you were going to come up
with. Now, how often would you get called out? I mean, who would call you? Not
we'd have
anybody.
Overall, we'd have 2 or 3 a month.
Now who's calling? The government?
Or are the people wanting fuel? When the flight service station's open there, they'd be talking to airplane and radio, and airplane say, hey, can we get any fuel or not? You know, and all. I'd say, yeah, I can call somebody out. After the flight service station called, well, the people had to do the actual calling themselves then, you know.
So y'all pretty much are obligated to fuel anybody?
We always like to do it. We charge them $20 above the cost, you know, service call we call it or something, you know, and that's cash money, you know.
That's interesting. Let's see here. The whole time you talk, I'm always thinking of something else to ask. One thing leads to another. I'm kind of at a loss right at the moment. But well, training. You know, we talked a little bit about education, but to be airport manager, is there any kind of training, certification, anything like that you have to do?
No, I know. You know, without a doubt, probably most of the airport managers now, you know, have got some kind of a bachelor's degree in business administration or something, you know.
But there's not even like even a certification or anything that you did?
No. Now there is some technical colleges that actually teach a course in airport administration. I think, you know, the old school back when I was working out there that would kind of train pilots plus any other parts of aviation related things was there was one in Oklahoma called Spartan School of Aviation. Mainly what they trained was pilots, but they also trained people, you know, to do the charter, you know, end of it and things like that, and that went right down to bookkeeping and so forth and all, but there was really nothing as such at airport administration at that time.
Let's see, I was going to ask you, thought of something and then I forgot it. Sorry about that.
No problem.
Well, what I'm trying to think of, is anything else that you can think of or that you'd like to share? Maybe I'll remember it here.
I'm like you. I'll probably think of something kind of later on. But
I don't know. This wasn't it. But what were the most common airplanes that? That came in, say, when you first started?
When I first started, you know, it was, you know, the single-engine Cessnas, and you had the twin-engine Cessnas, and then the P-51 Piper. Had a few single engines, but most of theirs were twin engine. But and the King Air, which is turboprop, there were a few turboprops when I first went to work out there. But then, of course, they began to get more and more different model of turboprops in. And all the business jets at that time were what we call turbojets, which wasn't a very efficient jet engine. It was kind of, we always kind of laughed and said it was kind of like pouring a water hose full of gasoline on a fire. I mean, you just had to keep the fire going. But then they came out with a fan jet engine. It was a lot more efficient, you know, and all. But the turboprops, and then along about in the late 80s or whatever, when the fuel prices went up drastically and all, a lot of these aviation aircraft outfits went out of business. Cessna went out of business almost, except for they were one making about two models for several years on there. But it's the biggest increase, I guess, is in the turboprop and really the little fan jet business. The small, you know, the smaller jet business jets, you know, that will carry six or eight people, have grown a whole lot. And I still go by the airport occasionally, and there's more and more of them around, you know, six or eight passenger jets, which your bigger corporations, of course, is just like, they're going to have the bigger jets. But like your Temple, when I retired, you know, they went, at one time they had the huge jet, the one I was talking about that in passenger configuration would carry about 80 passengers. But Temple has gone to the, I call them a mid-level business jet, which is a 10 or 12 passenger, three engine Falcon 50s or 900 versions. But you see it more and more of the business jets, and they're the smaller model, the smaller business jets, which is the, like I said, Temple was medium sized to large. The smaller business jets are not much more expensive than the turboprop airplanes. I mean, you're talking $2 million versus $2.25 million for a jet, which the speed is not that much difference either.
Like the Experimental Aircraft Association? I can't remember when that got started. Was that while you were still out there, or is that?
That was really started here in East Texas. Really took a hold about the time I retired and a little after. But of course, it's been around nationwide, I guess, for 50 years or so,
yeah,
whatever.
I think Oshkosh or something like that.
But by the time I retired, I seen less and less recreation flying, and more business. Which I guess, you know, that the economy done that. Used to a fella come out, you know, and fly around on a Saturday or something. You know, that's back when you was paying 50 cents a gallon for fuel or 75. When I went to work out there, I was telling you the other day, I've got a copy of a fuel invoice where Arthur Godfrey, the fellow that had the nighttime NBC television show out of New York, bought some fuel out there. My brother signed a fuel ticket. I've got a copy of Arthur Godfrey's signature on it. He bought 100 gallons of 100 octane gasoline for 38 cents a gallon. This was 1975. Now it's running well over $4 a gallon. And so that's the difference. And of course, you know, in the process, which everything else went up too, but it hadn't went up in relation to that, that priced a lot of the smaller folks that just like to fly around on Saturday out of the picture. And so more and more of your flying is strictly business instead of recreation now.
Who were some of the common or regular recreational pilots in those early days, your early days? That you can remember specifically, or?
Yeah, you had the Manning brothers and their dad. They were originally from Jasper, which Jerry wound up being chief pilot for Temple before he retired. And the Denham family in Lufkin had some airplanes back then. And
but Joe Denman?
No, Denham.
Denham
Storage.
Denham.
Yeah, D-E-N-U-M. Yeah, Robert Conner down here that's got the Conner. He had an airplane that he flew on Saturdays and stuff a lot. But some of them, a lot of them are dead and gone now, but they used to be a good bit of that. But like I said, it's turned more and more now into that. Now, there's a lot of the smaller businesses that put the airplane in the business name and use it for personal use, which they just divide it out on their taxes or whatever. But right now, you know, there's a lot of them that's got their airplane, like I said, under business, which they may use it to fly down to the beach for the weekend or whatever. But like I said, when I went to work out there, there was something like 35 airplanes based at the airport. When I retired in 2002, we had over 90. That's how much we'd grown. We'd grown in the time. Went from 35 to 90 airplanes over the airport.
And those mostly all stayed in county-owned hangars?
Right, yeah. Now, there was,
now they Temple were, owned their hangar, right?
Right. Temple owned theirs, and the foundry, Lufkin Industries, and the paper mill owned theirs. And essentially, the rest of them were owned by the county.
Now, the paper mill, did were y'all kind of aware of who was in and out all the time?
Pretty well.
I mean,
pretty well.
Or did they have to buy fuel for you to know?
We pretty well knew what was going on everywhere. I mean, which we wasn't actually nosy, but I mean, that's part of the business, you know.
Right. How much, I'm just curious about the paper mill as far as their, you know, it changed hands in several different
When something
times.
Was fixing to happen in a company, a lot of times we'd know it for some people actually.
Based on
there, because you'd see somebody come in, you start checking. We always had some way to look up airplane numbers so it's registered to.
Okay.
If say somebody come in with company A, B, you know, a whole lot, and they're choking beef, because they say, hey, they're doing business, they're doing something with them, you know, and stuff and all.
So they didn't necessarily have the company logo.
Right, you looked the number up. Yep.
Yeah. Look now, Temple, for a while, at least had the T-wheel on theirs, didn't they?
Yep. They stopped doing that when security became such an issue, you know.
Okay.
I mean, have somebody, you know, walk out there, some nut, throw a satchel bomb in an airplane just because they had their logo, they had it pissed off at them or something.
About when was that?
That was probably in the early 90s. That started disappearing. That used, you know, nearly every company used to have their deal on there, but it began to less and less of probably in the early 90s.
So nobody really marks their stuff?
There's still a few, but not very many.
Yeah.
Not very many.
Yeah. Okay. Well, doggone it. I knew there was more stuff, but like I said, I think we kind of covered most all of it. I'm sure we'll both probably remember a few things. What about as far as the county employees? Did the county employees' numbers change much over your time? Your approximately 30 years. I know the FAA and the feds kind of moved out, but
there's less works out there right now, but business is kind of down right now. From what I understand now, don't hold me to it. But also back then there were more youth working there, which I say like your cooperative agriculture students and part-time, and it kind of went to changing in the mid-80s, I guess, and we started working into more like a full-time profession working out there. And in fact, when I retired, everybody that worked for me was full-time. And so that put an older age bracket working out there then.
So you could
had its advantages after.
You couldn't do today what you did then.
No.
You couldn't start off like you did and work in summers and move in.
Not really. Now, you know, that's kind of a shame in ways, which is like good reasons for it, but it's a shame in ways. But the same goes for Temple over here, too. You know, Temple used to work a whole summer crew.
Right.
But it all turned into... We had a budget to operate off of, so much salaries, and also there's not that much at airport. The work goes on all year. It's not just a whole lot of summer. Hey, we can do all this maintenance because it went on all year. But I had a budget here, you know, and I knew that we had to keep this place open from 7 in the morning to 7 at night. Knew how many people it took to do it, to fuel the airplane and do the maintenance. So you kept them on. It turned into full time then, you know. But also back then, didn't have to pay overtime either, you know. But we went on to the retirement system, I guess, in the mid-80s was when the county first joined the Texas County District Retirement System, and that gave us a pretty good incentive to keep some employees in its own, because I'd always tell those guys, I said, listen, the hourly pay is not all that great out here, but it's retirement, and you know, that's the old time, you look at the end product of it, you know.
Yeah.
And that's true, because county retirement is pretty good, you know. Because it runs into the folks in Austin, you know, and all.
Yeah,
our retirement comes out of Austin.
Pulls in with other...
Texas County District Retirement
County,
System.
Yeah, with other counties and stuff. Okay.
And when I retired out here, I had some of the best guys work for me, and usually they'd been at other jobs. But one of them had been a foreman with Duncan Construction for 20-something years, and he had some eye problems. And he had to give it up for about a year. He had a detached retina and stuff, and... he'd done work for Duncan for 20-something years, and he had attached retina. And he was off for about a year, and he started looking for a job. And he just happened to come to the airport, you know, and all. And I started asking questions to folks about him. And all, I told him, man, this, you can't beat this old fella, you know, and all. And I hired him. And he made a dang good employee. And then another guy had worked for Lufkin Industries for a while, and he went through one of their layoffs, and I kind of picked him up at about the same time I did this first one. And he was probably 40 years old at the time, and he turned out to be a doggone, he's kind of a jack-of-all-trades guy. He'd work on it and do anything. And then when the paper mill went through one of their name changes or whatever and all, they done away with the Brushy Creek wildlife thing down here by Lake Livingston, they got rid of an employee that had been there with them for about 15 years. And this guy was 51, 52 years old, you know. I mean, it's... And I found some of my best employees that had been with other companies for years, but they was in that 50, 60 range where they wasn't ready to give it up. Yeah. And I had some good employees when I retired. And the guy that took over that was my assistant manager, Randy Carswell, is manager out there right now. He worked for me 14 years before I retired. And so I recommended him when I left, you know, and they kind of delayed about 6 months. But finally, they gave him the job. He's manager right now. And I'll say, I mean, if you get good people, hang on to them, you know.
Yeah, oh yeah, that's right. Well, I'll just give you one more opportunity. Is there anything else you care to share, or did I neglect, or did we omit anything?
That's all I can think of right off hand.
Let me just back up a little bit.
Okay.
You mentioned when you were born, born and raised in Burke.
My mother and I was raised in Burke from when they were kids. We lived in Burke until I was 6 years old. Dad and mother bought their place at Beulah, and we moved to Beulah.
Okay.
Lived out there until 1970. And mother and dad built a new brick house in Burke back up near the airport there. And they go back up there in 1970, which, you know, and I went to work originally for Temple at the airport in 72. So I was kind of gravitating all around the airport all this time. But like I said, when I was going out there when I was a little bit of a kid, I had no idea. I'd spend 30 years working out there, you know.
Now, who was your grandfather, the one you mentioned?
Clifford Morris. He's the one that I'd done the oral thing for. Clifford Morris.
Okay, yeah, yeah. So he used to take you
out there. Yeah, he'd carry me out there in his old 53 GMC pickup, and we'd stand there at that barbed wire fence watching the sage grass grow when those DC-3 was turning around. There's still some pretty good pictures on that Burke website of that old DC-3. I think Patsy may have put them on there, somebody.
Okay. How many acres was the airport when you started?
When I started, it was about 400 acres, but it's up now close to 700.
700 acres. And we've mentioned bush hogs and mowers quite a bit through all this. I imagine, how often did y'all mow, say, in the summer and spring when you actually had grass to mow?
When I first went to work out there, of course, the bush hogs weren't advanced as what they are now, and tractor and so forth. But the grass would get pretty scrubby before we would mow it.
Okay.
But you get more and more instrumentation. They got this instrument landing system in out there. At that time, you couldn't have grass. It would interfere with the landing system, the beams or whatever, if it got over so high. But I don't know, it's kind of a personal tick of mine, I guess you'd call it. I like to see well-mowed grass. And so I kept a guy, during the growing season, I kept a guy when I was manager on a bush hog pretty much all summer because I like a good mowed place.
Yeah.
But that is one of the biggest things that had to be done out there was that and the runway light maintenance. Now, them runway lights are real important because you got to...
How many lights per
there's one every 200 feet.
One every 200 feet.
And one every 200 feet on each side.
And you
continually fight fire ants and crawfish with those things out there.
Now, were they surrounded by pavement for the runway, or are they off of the
runway? They're 10 foot from the edge of the runway.
Okay, so they're surrounded by grass.
Yep, it's grass, and you know, the kind of soil we have there in East Texas, I mean, it's just gumbo or mess or whatever. Then in summer and spring, the fire ants are drawn to electrical fixtures.
Oh, yeah.
You continually having to keep the fire ants killed out of them.
So
between that and the mowing, that was the biggest maintenance we had.
Big part of the budget, huh?
Right.
Expense budget.
Yep. Sure
and
was.
I guess you maintained all your own equipment and everything.
Yep.
On rainy days
or something when there wasn't much aviation traffic out there, we always kept 4 or 5 gallons of paint, you know, and I always like to keep my guys busy. We always had 4 or 5 gallons of paint, and if it was a rainy day or something, wasn't much traffic, My guys, they'd be painting the wall somewhere. I mean, we kept it looking good.
Yeah.
Now,
you were there when they relocated the entrance.
Yep.
Right? Okay. You tell a little bit about that. What was going on with that?
Well, they needed to lengthen that runway and also to put that landing system in.
Okay.
It had to be in alignment with center line of that east-west runway, and you had to have it stretched out for 1,200 feet from the end of that runway, and that put it at the farm road up there. At Highway 59 almost. And if you remember, the old entrance run right through where the middle of that part of that runway is right now. Yeah, so we had to change entrances. Yeah. Actually, wherever we go into buying property, we had to buy property stuff to reroute that entrance road around that. But the landing system, primary reason that the entrance to the airport was closed and was moved over to 59 anyway, which, of course, business-wise and aesthetics, you know, it looks better off 59 anyway.
Yeah.
Right.
A lot of people maybe didn't even know it was there if they didn't have an entrance.
Yep.
Yeah.
But that was in 92 when we done all that.
92, moved all that.
Yep.
Planted the live oaks along there.
Yep, Mr. Temple paved those live oaks. There's 222 of them. I can tell you, every one of them had to water them for 3 years, and we had about 20 or 25 die during the summer because there's no watering system there.
How'd you water them?
Or a barrel and a bush hog.
Barrel
on a bush hog, filled up with water, and I had one guy, I'd drive the tractor, one guy would dip gallons of water out, poured around each tree. When they were young, first year, 222. I tell you, every one of them.
Man, that took a while, didn't it?
It did. I mean, between that and the mowing, it took 6 hours every couple of weeks to keep them up because, you know, I have a lot of weaving and some mowing.
I figured out how to have a long, long water hose and just pull it however distance between each tree. Let it sit there a while and pull it a little more.
Well, there's 222 of them.
Man, I know that took a lot of time. Wow. Yeah. All right, Marley, I guess that'll conclude the interview. I'll go ahead and stop it. I sure appreciate it.
All righty.